Welcome back to our series In Conversation With. We're exploring the lives and careers of people across Elgium to understand more about what brought them to asset management. This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Welcome back to Elgium Talks. I'm Eliza Grimmond. One quick thing before we start. Since we recorded this episode, Sonia's role has changed from Deputy Chief Investment Officer to Chief Investment Officer. Hope you enjoy. Thank you for joining us for another Elgium Talks in Conversation With. I'm Eliza Grimmond, investment writer, and here to talk equality, equestrianism and equities is our Deputy Chief Investment Officer, Sonia Loud. Sonia joined Elgium at the start of 2019 from Fidelity International, where she was head of equity. Beginning her career in finance at DWS Group in Frankfurt, Sonia became an award-winning equity manager. She then relocated to London to work at Schroders and Barings in the global equity and multi-asset portfolio sectors, and she has an MBA from Trium. Hi, Sonia. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
To kick off, let's talk a little bit about what led you up to this point. So what were your favourite subjects to study growing up?
So during my time at school, I really only had one aim, to become a professional horse rider. And I spent literally my entire spare time on a horse. And that sounds a lot, but you have to understand, in Germany, school normally finishes around 1, 2 p.m. So you have a lot more spare time outside school than you have here in the UK. And so it is fair to say that I did spend a considerable amount of time riding horses, competing at a regional level in dressage and show jumping. Now, after school, I wasn't really sure why, you know, what I wanted to do. And then I did something very typical for Germany. I started an apprenticeship, so a vocational training where you combine going to school and working for a company. And I did this with Deutsche Bank. And then after Deutsche Bank, I realized I did not want to go straight working for a bank, and then went on to university. And I first studied in Cologne and then went on to join a private university, which kind of brought you 1 year to Paris, 1 year to Oxford and 1 year to Berlin. And in each country, you had to do an internship. So I did a wide variety of, trial and error propositions. I did asset management at DWS. I did investment banking. I did consulting. And actually, I did work in marketing for a non-profit organization. So one could argue that I did thorough research on where my passion really is and what I would like to do. And I was fortunate enough that I had quite a few job offers in the end. And I decided that in terms of the cultural team fit and the interest for the job, that asset management would be my choice.
Spoken like a true analyst. So moving on to your role at Elgium now, could you give me a sort of brief outline of how you would describe your role currently?
Yeah, I think the role of Deputy Chief Investment Officer has a broad variety of tasks and covers actually quite a lot of stakeholders. First and foremost, you're working a lot with the fund managers, and I'm directly responsible for the entire teams around active equity, active fixed income, and the solutions team. So you're very much involved in understanding investment philosophies, understanding the attractiveness of the individual product propositions, understanding how the investment process and the research process helps these fund managers to achieve the objectives we have outlined to our clients. But then obviously it's not only the fund propositions. There's the whole area of operational setup, i.e. are we making sure that the fund managers can operate in an environment where the technology, the risk, compliance and all the other functions are set up in a way that allows for a smooth operation. So quite a broad range of tasks, but that is to some extent what I find extremely fascinating about the role.
And I suppose there are also big thematic shifts that we're seeing from investors, particularly around areas like environmental, social and governance. And how do you feel like you might be able to shape the role to really rise to those challenges?
It is a fascinating topic and one that the industry, I think, arguably has been quite slow to pick up on. And it's really the pressures that are arising from millennials, their idea around what asset managers should bring to the table. What is their responsibility in making the world a better place and addressing the big issues that have been, identified? And how can we, as the, intermediaries between the asset owners and the receiving companies, can make sure that we're investing responsibly so that there is actually positive externalities alongside the financial returns that we're obviously achieving with our investments?
So there's a kind of social imperative to what we're doing as large asset managers as well?
Yes, in a way, you know, we have the responsibility to invest capital that is entrusted to us and invest, obviously, alongside the objectives that either the client or we have outlined as an attractive proposition. But obviously, what we're realizing is that there's big issues arising, societal issues that do require the influence from big asset owners, because as we know, capital to some extent can direct or can influence the direction of travel. And it is through the engagement with companies where we can outline issues that we're observing, where we can work with companies to help them provide remedy against the concerns that have arisen and make sure that as such, you know, there is a positive impact, you know, not only from an individual company's point of view, but then obviously in aggregate on the environment, the economy and society and at large.
Absolutely. And as large asset owners, we can help even influence policy direction, even potentially apply pressure through lobbying governments as well.
Yeah, I think there have been calls for asset managers to join forces more than we're currently doing. And I think that is still work in progress. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a lot more knowledge and collaboration going on than it has been probably 10, 20 years ago. But there is still question marks whether this goes far enough and whether we can do more.
So stepping back into the role you've been in for a few months now, what were your initial thoughts when you walked in the door, and how do you think you might want to take the role forward now you've been in the role for a few months and you've seen how things work at LGIM?
I think there's a general and a general asset management aspect to it, to my answer, and then obviously specifically around LGIM. Everything we've just discussed obviously means that there is profound changes going on, and asset managers currently are trying to identify how best to adapt and how to provide an agile operating model that allows for changes to be implemented more frequently. Because I guess we have to understand that, you know, that it is, there's no status quo yet. There's still a lot of change that we have to capture and understand, notwithstanding the fact that that client demands have been changing. Now, if you look at LGIM, I think there's a tremendous opportunity, but it requires as well to understand that the DNA of the company is very squarely in the UK and within UK DB clients. So understanding that this will not drive growth over the next 10, 20 years, and to put it bluntly, that the next trillion will not come from that client base, we have to understand where the growth opportunities are. We have to identify the right product mix for those growth opportunities. And we have to make sure that we have the right skill set, the right operating model, the right platform to cater for those growth opportunities. I find it incredibly exciting. And I think we have a lot to offer. Just thinking about areas like Europe and Asia where we are present but not really represented, because we have the chance to, you know, shape the brand, to, you know, portray an image and to really come up with great product solutions for clients in those regions.
And I suppose more broadly, how does your work feed into the fund management process itself? Could you expand on where and how, for example, your macro views are applied, as well as your strategic vision, which you've just outlined?
So first and foremost, I'm sitting with and among fund managers. So we are all on one floor, which actually was a novelty for me, because I've not worked for an organization before where you had literally the entire investment team on one floor. With that, you have quite a distinct, intimate knowledge that everybody has across the board on across asset classes, on individual areas, which is quite unique. And so that in itself provides a great backdrop for communication and interaction. But then obviously we have official strategy week meetings where we discuss in separate meetings across 1 week. We think about macroeconomic themes. We look at individual asset classes. We think about the multi-asset context. And I'm trying whenever I can to be part of those meetings to understand how our investors, how our fund managers are thinking, whether the logic stacks up, and whether we have the most rigorous discussion possible to make sure that the end result for our clients is the best possible. Then I will have individual meetings with fund managers. We do fund reviews to, again, make sure that the fund manager and that it manages the fund in the context of the outline proposition and that there is sufficient transparency and clarity around the investment process. So there's a lot of kind of contact points where, you know, I try to make sure I understand what the current thinking of the investment floor is, and that obviously then I can use those thoughts as well when I speak to the media or other events.
Swiveling back to sort of your life outside of work, you mentioned earlier that you have a young family. How might you explain, the role you've just described to me, to your friends and your family?
That is a tricky one. I tried for a long time to explain what a fund manager does to my mum. I think I've finally succeeded 10 years into my fund manager career. So I think it is interesting then to obviously explain what this strategic angle implies. Although to some extent it might be a bit easier in terms from the managerial responsibility. But then you come to the point, what does legal and general investment management do? You know, what is the purpose of the company? And I think here really this idea of helping people understand their financial needs and helping them achieve their financial goals is probably the best summary I can come up with. Although then obviously my children, given that they're 6 and 8, would probably ask what financial needs are, given that for them that still kind of ends with mummy and daddy to ask for.
I suppose that's a bit of a chicken and egg question in terms of teaching them about finance. But yes. I mean, you know, I think they're in a good position to start learning. And I mean, you're a high profile woman in an industry that's only really relatively recently beginning to see strong female representation at the top. How has the landscape changed across your career? And I mean, in your opinion, what factors have helped in your success?
There has been a lot of change, and I think it's good change. It's very positive change. When I remember, so I came to the UK in 2005, and you know, thinking back to that time, what is clear is that networking opportunities were quite rare at the time. And I joined as a senior fund manager in a predominantly male kind of fund manager desks. And I do remember that I did struggle to find someone, you know, who I could use as a sounding board and where I could really kind of start, you know, discussing ideas and, you know, positions and views. It did change. So in 2007, I had my first coach, and that was a bit of an eye opener. Wonderful lady. She's a professor for change management, and she really provided me with a lot of perspective around, you know, my positioning and the thoughts I had. And I've had a coach actually ever since. And I think, again, this is a topic that's that companies pick up much more readily these days to understand that the importance of mentoring, coaching and providing guidelines for employees. And not only for women, let's face it, this is equally applicable to men. And it should be. It should be applied to men as well, because we don't want the pendulum to swing too much in the other direction so that it now seems we're only favouring women over men. This is particularly important, from my mind, for young men entering the industry. So it cannot have the perception that all of a sudden it's only about women. It's a balance. It's the skills you bring to the table. And I think I always have been very honest with myself and the skills that I do bring to the table. And if you think back around the stations of my career, then you can see that there has been a deliberate choice to not only cover equities where I started, but then take a break, do the executive MBA, and then cover actually multi-asset to be in a position to have knowledge across the board in a broader spectrum, cover the asset allocation piece as well, which I think hopefully provides me with a much more rounded skill set than I had before.
So it's about developing those networks, but also maybe pushing yourself a little bit into those areas that you're maybe less naturally comfortable with to ensure that you have the right skill set to go to your senior manager and say, OK, now I'm ready to be promoted. Now I'm ready to be put in the limelight, and pushing yourself forward in that way.
Yeah. And I think we have, as a company, we will have to provide a much more transparent framework around this. You know, what are the expectations around various grade levels? You know, what kind of skill sets, behaviours would we like to see from people entering the job and then progressing through the grades? Because I think it has to be transparent, because people need to be able to assess themselves against these. And it hopefully provides a much more transparent kind of, framework than for discussing year-end appraisals.
And so are you personally involved in creating this transparency and developing these networks as well?
Yes, we have started to discuss what we need to do to make this a fairer and more transparent approach. We started a trial for lean in circles as well. I'm involved in mentoring as well. So I think that there's a lot of very positive things going on. And hopefully we're transparent enough so that everybody has access to them as well.
That's fantastic. Speaking of the future, what are the key industry changes that you've seen more broadly across your time in asset management?
There's, I think, only one elephant in the room, particularly given the fact that I've spent most of my career managing active funds. It's the rise of passive and the influence this had, not only on cost structures, but on the way we think about asset allocation and what actually a good investment proposition looks like. This has had profound impacts already, but to my mind will shape the industry even more so going forward. And we have to understand as well that the cost consideration is a much more important factor than it used to be in the past. So we now have a triangular objective set from clients, which always will be risk and return. But now we have to add cost to it. And maybe actually eventually we will add a fourth factor to it, which will be ESG. Hopefully ESG eventually will be integrated into the risk return consideration, but you see very often that clients will look at this as a separate line item. And that's meaningful changes compared to the past and will require a big rethink across asset managers on how to define product propositions and how the operational setup has to change to accommodate those changes.
And I suppose asking the same question, but with a different side of the coin, just to wrap up, what are the trends no one's talking about at the moment? I mean, you see a lot of things in your role. You see countless research papers. You have access to meetings that very few other people will. Are there any hidden trends or themes that you think you've picked up on that?
Not necessarily hidden, but more for me a direct consequence of what I've just outlined. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, if you think back 10, 15 years ago, before we've had this tremendous rise of passive propositions, you've obviously have seen kind of an enormous launch of product propositions that were called active, but where we realize now that, you know, with performance targets that are only slightly above the reference index, you are now having to question whether these are still called active. And as a consequence of this, we have to redefine what a good active proposition looks like. And that is a change that, to my mind, has only started because it will have real implications on a lot of business models within the asset management industry. Because the traditional models of analyst-based, you know, recommendations that are then placed into the portfolio context, there has been sufficient criticism already that most of these are not delivering a good outcome for clients. Yet there has not been real change in addressing this and changing the way that a lot of these portfolios are still managed. And that is a fascinating one because it will allow for product innovation. It will allow for new trends to emerge, but it means as well that there's big disruption in very traditional asset management fields where we have to look at the cost and the efficiency ratios and plainly whether the outcome, the way it was defined, is still valid. And what I mean by this is if you look at a fund's prospectus in the good old days, it would merely say the fund's aim is to outperform the market. What is outperform? Is it 20 basis points, 50? And then obviously here, the cost consideration, again, is very important. And so to my mind, that is a real rupture that potentially will allow for those that capture this trend early to massively benefit from it.
So there are big changes that could change the fundamental way in which we manage money altogether, as well as the way we market and sell products, and even the way we conceive of products, really, I think, is what you're trying to say to me.
Yeah, the idea is that the idea of a product solution will be a much more important theme because in the context of everything I've highlighted, it just shows the complexity that clients are facing in achieving their objectives for their asset allocation. So for us, in order to be successful, we have to bring it all together. And this is what the exciting part for Elgin, because most of the product propositions we have already, we can now work on the missing links, where the white gaps, where we believe we can have we can deliver a real edge over our peers. And as such, bring it all together in a way that is not only meeting the risk return objectives of the client, but will meet the cost objectives as well, and most likely eventually the ESG objectives as well.
Thank you so much, Sonia. Just two final quick questions before we let you go. What's the best thing you've read so far in 2019?
It's actually the autobiography from Michelle Obama. It's becoming. It's a really, really nice way of telling her story.
Fabulous. And what's your dream holiday destination?
It's not a single spot. It's somewhere nice and sunny, but not too hot, with lots of sporting facilities, lots of good food and wine.
Lots of diversification opportunities. Well, thank you very much, Sonia. Really appreciate you coming down to the studio today, and it's been a really interesting conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Join us next week for another episode of Elgin Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.